From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Professor James Papandrea, co-author of How Christianity Saved Civilization and Must Do So Again. Let's now join Hank and Dr. Papandrea in their conversation.
When Christians in the early centuries of the church had to explain themselves to the broader culture, they would explain themselves based on differences in behavior. And they would say things like, we share our food, but we don't share our wives. And, you know, these would be ways that they would make a contrast between Christians and non-Christians. And one of the things that they always said was, we are people who do not kill our children. We do not abort our children. We are the people who rescue and protect children. That's who we are.
Abortion, the watershed issue of our day, in your opinion?
It is definitely one of them. Yeah. I mean, for me personally, it is probably the number one concern in terms of social issues. And I would argue, this is just me, I'm not speaking for Mike here necessarily or anybody else, but I would argue that if you were to put a date on the year that we really turned a corner in terms of like turning away from a Christian culture toward a post-Christian culture, I would argue that that would be 1973, when we saw the legalization of abortion in this country, that that's when we turned that corner. That's just me.
Yep. Well, I think you make a great point. So many great points that I have personally garnered from your work and from listening to you. One of them is the insightful observation that widows and orphans are like the Holy Eucharist. I just got back from Southeast Asia a short while ago, and I had an opportunity to see just how denigrated widows are in certain cultures that still have remnants of widow burning, cultures in which, to this day, a widow is a cursed person, and so someone doesn't want to marry a widow. And so the widows are oftentimes not taken care of. And I had the opportunity to see and be involved in a mission that's building homes for widows because they're ostracized. And you make this incredible point that gave me chills when I read the book. The parallel between widows and orphans and the Holy Eucharist. And I was hoping in the podcast you could expand on that for our audience, because Christ makes a big point of this as well, caring for widows and the orphans. And this is emblematic of caring for the poor.
Well, yes, it is. And I think, if I remember right, that comment about the widows and orphans being like the Holy Eucharist, I can't take credit for that. I think that comes from one of the church fathers. And if I remember right, it might be John Chrysostom. But I mean, you know, you see this already in Judaism too, this idea of, you know, concern for the widow, the orphan, the, you know, the stranger in your midst. And this carries through to Christianity as well. And here's the bottom line. This idea that we ought to care for the vulnerable and for those who can't take care of themselves, it really flies in the face of the sort of, you know, pagan assumptions that there are certain people who are less valuable, there are certain people who are a burden on you or on society, there are certain people who exist for your benefit, there are certain people who have less of a right to exist. All of these kinds of things are assumptions that are built into Roman culture. And here comes Christianity, and the Christians say, no, right? We are going to take care of our widows. We are going to take care of our orphans. And the early church, of course, even had what we might call a lay order of widows whose ministry it was to pray. And they were supported by the church. And the church saw that as a valuable, worthwhile ministry and something worth giving alms to support the widows. The church also instituted very early forms of, you know, what we might call monastics. At the beginning, they were mostly women. So they had this thing called the Order of Virgins, which was a way that women, if they weren't married or for whatever reason, if they wanted to have an alternative to marriage, the church supported them as well. And so this is, of course, you know, an early version. Now we have our religious communities. And so it wasn't this attitude that, well, you know, a person has to sort of prove their right to exist by contributing, you know, in some way. It was the assumption that everyone has a right to exist. Everyone is equal. Every person is valuable. No one is expendable or disposable. And that was the church's conviction from the beginning. And, you know, it made the non-Christians look bad and they didn't like it, but it eventually converted the world.
If you're someone who has very little concept of history, you might well fall for the ruse that America invented slavery. But you point out that slavery was part and parcel of ancient civilizations and certainly was a predominating factor in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, of course, you know, you can't read the New Testament without noticing that, like, St. Paul, for example, talks about slavery and doesn't really critique it. And you might wonder why. Well, it's because even St. Paul can't envision a world without slavery, because slavery has been a part of, you know, pretty much every human culture. But eventually, the Christian church could envision a world without slavery. And by the third century, you get Christians saying, look, slavery is not compatible with our concept of humanity made in the image of God. We got to get rid of this. And, you know, eventually the church all but got rid of slavery before it came back again in the 16th or 15th century.
Second revolution that you talk about in the book is a revolution of the home. And then in that context, you make the point that we've already sort of talked about, which is that the notion of family comes from the nature of God himself, comes from the nature of a triune God.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, like I was saying before, you know, the church valued children in a way that the culture didn't. So, you know, children are seen as a blessing, not a burden. And we know for a fact that in Roman culture, way more girls were killed after they were born than boys, because the girls were seen as a burden. Then the church said no to this too. And the church saw its role in society as protecting children, girls, young boys who would be at the risk of abuse by older men in Roman culture, protecting women, protecting the family, protecting marriage as, you know, meant to be monogamous and even sacramental. You know, adultery was, you know, Mike likes to say adultery was the number one pastime in Rome. But it's really true that when you look at Roman laws, adultery is usually described as something a wife does by cheating on her husband, but a man can go out and hire a prostitute, or a man can go out and have sex with another woman. As long as she's not the wife of another man, he isn't doing anything wrong by Roman standards, right? And if she is the wife of another man, he's only doing something wrong because he's stealing something from the other man. Right? He's not sinning against his own wife. So it's a completely different understanding of what marriage and family is. You know, if you think our culture has any kind of a history of valuing family, well, we got that from Christianity.
Yeah. The revolutions are, and again, you're using that in a not a strictly denotative way,
yeah,
using the word revolution in a connotative way in some sense. But you're talking about a third revolution as a revolution of work. And I want to zero in on that for just a moment, because in the Roman Empire, as you make plain, work was not an ideal. The ideal was to be free from work and have the slaves work for you. And so if you're working, you're really denigrating yourself. So Christianity comes into that culture, and St. Paul is a tent maker, and you have shoemakers, and you have people who are involved in using their hands and pointing out that work, in a sense, is sacramental.
Yeah, that's right, that there is a real dignity to labor. And, you know, it's so funny when you read the Roman documents, the way the Romans look down on anyone who has to work for a living. about the only occupation that they don't completely look down on is farming, I think. But if anyone's in business, oh, they're just getting their hands dirty. And of course, these are Roman documents written by wealthy men, but the desirable occupation, and see if this sounds familiar, the desirable occupation is to own things and draw an income from the things you own and not actually do any work for yourself. And I always laugh, you know, when they talk about, well, who should be a senator? Well, obviously, wealthy people should be senators because since they're wealthy, you know they can be trusted. That's the Roman logic there.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. James Papandrea. Ancient Rome's brutal culture exploited the weak and considered human life expendable. Women were used as property. Unwanted children were left on the streets to die. Four centuries later, even ordinary men and women prospered in what had become a vigorous new Christian society. A society that served the vulnerable, exalted women, treasured virtue, and loved peace. Faith had triumphed as truth was proclaimed. The book How Christianity Saved Civilization and Must Do So Again by Mike Aquilina and James Papandrea offers hope that followers of Christ may once again transform a dark and hostile culture. To receive your copy of How Christianity Saved Civilization and Must Do So Again, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Hank Hanegraaff has dedicated his life to defending truth because truth matters. Yet an encounter with Christians in the underground Church of China left Hanegraaff contemplating his Christian experience. They were experiencing something beyond truth. They were experiencing life. Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God. Prepare to move past intellectually knowing about God to experientially knowing God in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, The Unexpected Beauty of an Authentic Christian Life, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. James Papandrea, as they continue their conversation.
And I always laugh, you know, when they talk about, well, who should be a senator? Well, obviously, wealthy people should be senators because since they're wealthy, you know they can be trusted. That's the Roman logic there. But the other thing is that there is a responsible use of money versus an irresponsible use of money. Money exists as a way to share resources, not as a way to hoard resources. And I think that's a very important critique that the church had for the greater culture.
Yeah, and something that you underscore so beautifully in the book, if you think about the triple braided cord of prayer and fasting and almsgiving, the early church fathers oftentimes put the import on almsgiving above even prayer and fasting, because giving is not only good for the world, it's good for the soul, which endures for all eternity in a resurrected body.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, another way to think of it very simply is almsgiving helps two people, not just one. It helps the giver and it helps the receiver. And this is interesting, too, because we can see the very early stages of the sacrament of confession and penance because it's connected with almsgiving. But from the very beginning in the early church documents, we see the importance of almsgiving as a penance or as a ministry, we might call it. And the interesting thing is that it's not as though there's some hope that if, you know, by enough almsgiving, we'll get rid of poverty. That's not really the goal. The goal is that by giving alms, you are sharing your resources with those who are less fortunate, but they have a ministry too. And so it's their responsibility then to pray for you. So there's this really interesting symbiotic relationship between those who have and those who don't have. Those who receive the alms are meant to pray for those who give them.
One of the quotes in the book that I noted was, "The storehouses of heaven are the stomachs of the hungry." St. John Chrysostom said that the rich exist for the sake of the poor, and the poor exist for the salvation of the rich. I want you to elaborate on a common phenomenon that we all run into now in the streets of America, fairly recent phenomenon in terms of its proliferation throughout the country. Whenever you come up to a stop sign or a stoplight, you see people panhandling. Some people are really good at it. They can act as though they have real serious maladies. There was a particular situation that took place where three or four of my family members were coming from church and they all gave money to the same person, probably for the same reason. Whether it was authentic or not, I don't know. It seems to me that the church fathers often talked about that it's not our responsibility to find out whether this need is genuine or not genuine. Our responsibility is just to give.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That is the consensus, I think, of the church fathers. And so in a general sense, I always try to approach someone who is begging for alms without any sort of judgmental, you know, like I try not to assume that poverty is the fault of the poor, that they're somehow lazy and that's why they're in that situation. I try not to assume that, you know, they have to use the money according to my values in order for me to give. There are ways to give that sort of would prevent a person from just, you know, buying alcohol with it or whatever. And so I have in the past made a point to carry, you know, like a $5 McDonald's gift card on me or something like that. And just, you can just hand that to the person. But I will say this, I really don't like what I call the left turn beggars. I don't like that because I feel like it's dangerous. I think somebody out there is going to cause an accident or get hit by a car or something. And I don't like it. And I say that even for when it's, you know, the firefighters out there collecting for muscular dystrophy or the Misericordia folks. I mean, these are all great, very worthy charities, and I want to give to them, but not when I'm trying to turn left at a stoplight. I don't like it. So that's just me. But you're right. In general, if we are approached by someone who asks us for money, the church fathers would say, count that as God's voice asking you to give. And don't worry about what they do with it. That's on them, not on you.
Yeah, yeah. Another revolution, I think this is about the fourth revolution in the book, is the revolution of religion. And this is an incredible chapter. It's chapter 5 in the book. And it's the revolutionary idea that God is love and that we can enter into the fellowship of the Holy Trinity. But it also underscores the absolute criticality of the church. You mentioned earlier that it has become a blood sport to criticize the church or to say that the church has to become more relevant. We have to revitalize the church or rejigger the church or whatever adjective you want to use there. But you're talking about the church as the epicenter of the universe. We did touch on this before, but I think it's so important, particularly in that you have a chapter devoted to it, to talk about the criticality of the church and the church properly understood, because there are so many counterfeits of the church where you lose the sacramental life of the church. I often tell the story about speaking in a megachurch before I converted to Orthodox Christianity. And I remember the pastor who was introducing me saying all kinds of very nice things about me and said, when Hank gets done speaking, by the way, there's some grape juice and crackers in the back of the church. Grab some on the way out. And so you miss the liturgical, the sacramental life of the church, which is something that is rather recent in terms of a phenomenon. I mean, it was not that way for the first 1,000 years or even the first 1,500 years of church history.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, the very fact of schism, the splitting or factioning of the church, is a huge problem. And I mean, the reason for that is because the church, by its very nature, is meant to be universal. The universal church. You mentioned the Galatians passage earlier. There is neither or no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, right? The idea is that everyone, the church is open to everyone. And the reason why this is such a revolution in the Roman world is because most religions in the ancient world, before Christianity came along, and even Judaism is one of them, most religions were specific to a certain kind of person. A certain ethnic group, a certain national group or tribe, or a certain occupation. Some religions were for the soldiers and the sailors, and some were for men only, and others were for women only. What's so radical about Christianity is that it's for everyone. And if you think about how Jesus set the precedent when he chose his 12 disciples, you have fishermen, you have zealots, you have a tax collector. I mean, imagine if you tried to start a Bible study today and you said, okay, well, we're going to invite Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Rush Limbaugh, Barack Obama. You know, we're going to like get all these people who normally should never be expected to sit down at the same table. And that's going to be our core, right? And that's what Jesus did. And he started something. And you know, we aren't always good at continuing this aspect of the church, but it is supposed to be for everyone and universal. And it is supposed to be a thing where rich and poor and everybody of every color can sit down at the same table. That table of the Eucharist is supposed to be a table of unity.
Elaborate on that a little bit. I was reading an article in our local newspaper, and they had listed actually LGBTQ-friendly churches. And they were making a dichotomy between those churches that are LGBTQ friendly and those which are not. So you're pointing out that people from all persuasions of life are welcome in the church. What are the limitations?
Well,
are there limitations from your
perspective? Yeah. I mean, I assume that when anyone talks about a church that is friendly to a particular demographic, fill in the blank, what they mean by friendly is friendly on the terms of that demographic group. So in other words, if I am a thief, I'm a cat burglar, and I want to join the church, and the pastor says to me, well, you know, we'd love to have you, but we're going to ask you to, you know, find a different occupation. Or maybe the pastor would say to me, you know, you're welcome here, but, you know, cat burglars aren't able to serve in leadership functions, right? So membership, attendance, even receiving the sacraments is one thing. But I think what we need to do is clarify that there is a difference between membership friendly and leadership friendly. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but you're also making this point in the book where the church is not to conform to the culture, it is to conform the culture to Christ. So, as you point out, it's one thing to say that you welcome all people, but you don't welcome a conformity to the culture. The church is a change agent in the culture. So it's counter-culture in that sense.
That's right.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor James Papandrea. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of How Christianity Saved Civilization and Must Do So Again by Mike Aquilina and James Papandrea. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is essentially two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God in Christ. Simply put, the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We cheat ourselves of authentic union with Christ when we elevate the message above the Messiah. Truth Matters, Life Matters More is a modern classic and the magnum opus of one of the great theological minds of our time. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift in support of the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.